Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Tough task. I'm between you and cocktail hour, so I'll try and make this as easy as possible. But there are two reasons, of course, to look forward to this cocktail hour. India is 60 years old today. Born 60 years ago, a very young nation, a very old civilization, but a very young nation, 15th August 1947. But the second reason, of course, to celebrate, we beat England in cricket after 28 years in England. Right, let's get this started. The title of my presentation, ladies and gentlemen, is The Elephant Begins to Dance. For all these 60 years of, well, 60 minus 12, because 1991 we started our reform process, everybody said, what is this crazy mad country, the bloody elephant, you know, it's ponderous, it's slow, it has growth rates of 2%, and look at all these tiger economies and the dragons, and you know, they're going all over the place, and India going nowhere. Well, a certain Lou Gerstner, former chairman of IBM, or chairman at the time that he came to India to open IBM's global R&D center. It is not a subsidiary center, it is the major R&D establishment for IBM in our city of Bangalore. Lou Gerstner says, who says elephants can't dance? Look at India. So let's get a little bit of history, ladies and gentlemen. You're Australians here, most of you. Do you know who the first European into this country was? It was not Captain Cook. Don't let the Brits fool you. In the year 1616, an intrepid Dutchman called Dirk Hartog of the Dutch East India Company, headquartered in the Indian city of Cochin, first came to what is today Indonesia, and then landed in Shark Bay, Western Australia. Now, of course, Dirk Hartog went back with his ships, didn't stay on, so there was no colonization at that time. But the date of 1616 is very important for India particularly. A certain gentleman called Thomas Rowe Esquire arrived in the city of the Taj Mahal, that is Agra, and came as Britain's first ambassador to the Mughal court. Thomas Rowe became the drinking companion of the great Mughal emperor Jahangir. And this drinking friendship, which is why cocktail hours are important, culminated in the world's first ever bilateral trade agreement. So, ladies and gentlemen, our POMs had arrived. Yours came much later. And the reason I'm bringing this up is, of course, this famous saying from Santayana, those who do not learn from history are condemned to repeat it. This is important to know what the history was. So let's get this in perspective. Let's start with the year 1000 AD. 28.9% of global GDP was from India. That is India's share. Reduced slightly in 1500, 24.5% of global GDP came from India. Started 1700 is significant. We've seen what happened when Thomas Rowe and the date thereof. Even by 1700, the percentage share was 22.6%, higher than all of Europe put together. And boom, come 1913, it's down to 7.6%. And at time of independence in 1947, look what happened. India's share of global GDP was down to under 4%. So here's the world's richest country in 1500, richer than all of Europe put together, richer than China, was reduced to bankruptcy in the year of 1947 at the time of our independence, only 60 years ago. I've just put some other figures. The last one is important. I have not written it. It's come from Goldman Sachs. They believe that by 2050, India will be back up to 15% of global GDP. That is where that country is heading. Let's look a little more at history. India's relationship with the West goes back first, second millennium BC. It was trading with the Phoenicians. King Solomon's ships were coming into India, 950 BC. We're talking BC, ladies and gentlemen, not AD. Alexander the Great invaded India after coming through Persia and Afghanistan, arrived in India. 327 BC establishes the first four ever international trading centers, four cities called Alexandria in India, long before Alexandria in current Egypt was formed. The Roman trading fleets were coming in 45 AD, and those of you who know your Bible, St. Thomas arrived in our city of Madras, now Chennai, in 52 AD. In fact, he preached and died. And if you go into Madras airport, there's a little hillock next to the airport that St. Thomas's mound. He's buried there. But also, of course, the Arabs were trading by the overland route. And the Arabs were predominantly trading on behalf of somebody else. And they were the Venetian merchants and traders. But the real change took place when the intrepid Marco Polo took the overland route, went through the first two of the BRIC countries that we've heard of. He went through Russia, landed up in China. And there he was told that, look, I mean, this is not the greatest place in the earth. There's another country. You've got to go and look those guys up. So Marco Polo, on his way back from China, came to the third BRIC country, which is India. And he came to South India in the year 1292. And went home with the message. He says, my God, we've gone to the wrong country. You should be looking at India. That's where all the wealth is. We've seen the numbers. And that, of course, set all the ruling monarchies of Europe to look for this great sea route to India. The land route was already dominated by the Arabs. It was very difficult to get past. The geography was difficult. So a lot of these intrepid sailors set out to find India. And a certain Christopher Columbus was perhaps the first, took up the challenge, came to find India. As history tells us, he took a wrong turning and found Indians of a very different color. But the Portuguese were the first. By then, they had learned about something called the compass. And they came around the tip of South Africa, Cape of Good Hope, and arrived in India in 1498. Now the sea routes were open. Everybody knew how to come to India. In 1604, the Dutch came. And these are countries that I mentioned are the ones which colonized parts of India. There were others, of course, who were coming. After the Dutch, shortly thereafter, the British came, 1608. 1618, the Danes came and colonized parts of India. And then we had the French. And in 1784, the U.S. trading ships started to come. I have not included Sweden, Germany, Russia, who all, of course, just came to trade. While, of course, we had a relationship now with the West, India had a long-standing relationship also with Asia. Some of these dates, important, not important, but the last one is rather interesting. 1405 AD. The Chinese trading fleets under Admiral Zheng He, reputedly now to have found the Red Indians before Christopher Columbus did, they were coming into our port of Calcutta. What is this telling us? Clearly then, India was the first globalized economy. We were trading with the whole world, from the United States to China and Japan. Buddhism had already spread to China and Japan. The Buddhist scholars coming in from all over to study in the first ever university of the world in a city called Nalanda, very close to where my wife was born. So, ladies and gentlemen, in the 17th century, India's GDP was $90.8 billion, almost 25%, as we've seen, of global GDP. Per capita income, $550, higher than that of the United States. It was also home to the first ever multinational in the world, the Dutch East India Company. The others came later, the British East India Company and the French. It was also home to the first international protectionist barriers, which the British established in Indian commerce. And the first ever corporate wars. I mean, we talk these days of boardroom battles and corporate wars, but these were real wars. The French East India Company fighting the British East India Company with cannons, guns, muskets, whatever. Real wars. But then news of all this wealth started to go up to the British Crown and say, why should this company of merchants make all the money? I mean, surely we deserve a piece of the action. And a certain Lord Clive, who was then an officer in the British East India Company, was made India's first Governor General. So, of course, in addition to what went to the Crown, Lord Clive was pocketing some of it himself and became rather rich. Thought he would be landed gentry, but anyway, he ended up in prison. We had subsequently also others who did the same thing, Lord William Hastings, as those you might have read in history. But to raise even more money, they introduced penal taxation in the country. They imposed export and import controls. And that resulted, the capital of then British India was in our city of Calcutta, and Bengal was then the state in which they operated. Because of the penal taxation, 3 million people in Bengal died of famine. There was no money because they had to pay for the British Crown. Then India was made to pay for British participation in the two world wars. Result, as we've noticed before, from the richest country in the world to a bankrupt nation at the time of independence. But not everything the British did really was bad. I give them due credit. They gave us the English language, which is today our national language, one of two. They gave us, left us with a good legal system, a working bureaucracy, perhaps an overworking bureaucracy of those who've dealt with India, a modern education system, which is why we produce all these great IT fellows and all these accounting champions. Some of them are here today. Some very good scientific establishments, research and development establishments. And of course, we also then acquired a new religion, a little cherry striking some stumps. And we now beat them at their own game. So, having been bankrupted in 1947, the leading industrialists of our country at that time went to the Prime Minister, Mr. Nehru, and said, well, there's no money. And to get the economy going can only be done by a state-led revival. It's called the Bombay Plan. Prime Minister Nehru was already very impressed by the USSR, and of course, having been educated in the United Kingdom, and was very impressed with Fabian socialism. Oh, that's the way to go. And then, as we've recently learned from Pamela Mountbatten's book, his rather close friendship with Edwina Mountbatten didn't amount to very much at that time, perhaps led him to say, well, we should kick out these Brits and not have anything further to do with them, and we need a wholly new different system. So India went quote-unquote socialist. A concept of mixed economy was started, which basically meant that all the big industry and all the companies in the limelight were public sector. They were government companies paid for by the taxpayer. The private sector, which existed, was allowed to continue at its own pace. There was no incentives given for them to expand. Now, as a result of all of these problems with our colonial masters, there were not one, as we've seen, there are several of the European countries that had pockets of colonies in our country. After independence, anything foreign was suspect. Foreign entities were suspect, and hence, during our socialistic days, foreign companies were really not welcomed. If there was a problem, you blamed it on the foreigner. There, something went wrong. It's either CIA or MI6 or KGB. If it continues till today, as you know, we lost in cricket a year ago, lost to Bangladesh, my God, in the World Cup. It was not our fault. It was Greg Chappell. Kick out that coach. He's a bloody Australian guy. So the motto was, become self-reliance at any cost. A good example that I gave is when the whole world was using Xerox photocopiers or Canon photocopiers. We decided to make our own. I mean, it was almost as large as this stage, a box of carbon little balls, and you shook this little cylinder until you got a coating of carbon, and then you put the paper on top. I mean, they made four of them in the National Physical Laboratory. They're sitting in a museum now, but that was self-reliance for us. When Prime Minister Nehru passed away, his daughter, there was a brief interlude with Mr. Shastri, but of course Indira Gandhi became Prime Minister, really against the wishes of the political powers that were at that time. So she had to do something quite spectacular so that the people would support her. And of course she took the socialism even further. Nationalized banks, nationalized the insurance companies, put further controls on growth of private business houses, and in the year 1972 imposed what we call the emergency, which basically for a couple of years took away our freedom of the rights that we enjoyed before and are currently enjoying. We also had some border problems with our cousins on both sides, the northwestern side and northeastern side, and hence there was massive increase in defense expenditure. You put this all together, churn it, and what happened? By 1990, this country was bankrupt again. There was no money. We were down, India was down to reserves of 1 week's imports. We actually had to put some gold from our reserve bank, put them in airplanes, take them to Geneva and borrowed against gold. That is one thing India has always been very proud of. It has never welched on any international debt. It was not going to welch this time. So take the gold out, get the money, let's get it started. Mercifully, we had a rather competent finance minister in 1991. Dr. Manmohan Singh, who is today our prime minister, decided enough of this socialism nonsense. Let's stop this economy going. So, ladies and gentlemen, in 1991, economic reforms were introduced in India, and the date is significant 12 years after the Chinese introduced reforms. So when people like to compare India and China, give us that 12 years plus the handicap of being a slow-running democracy. So let's get the perspective clear. But what is India today? And this is now, we are highlighting all of this now. It is a free and open democratic society. Between 1947 and 1991, we've seen we're bankrupt, no money, we're the largest recipient of foreign aid, which is why this elephant didn't go anywhere. Today, India is a net provider of foreign aid. It does not take any aid from any foreign country. We do not even take aid or material help or people when we have natural disasters like the tsunami. In fact, when the big tsunami struck, India, of course, had problems, but then our Navy was out within hours to help Sri Lanka and Indonesia. We were quite happy. It's our region of influence. So India is coming back to its rightful position, and we seek our rightful position on the United Nations Security Council as a permanent member. And India, as we all know, is emerging now as a major economic power. I'm not going to bore you with some statistics, perhaps you know most of these anyway. But the last one is significant. By the year 2025, if this trend continues, and in fact it seems to be getting better, the latest figures indicate that over the last four or five years we've had 9% GDP growth. It's now going to go up to 10% in the next fiscal. So if this continues, by the year 2025, you will have 120 million high-income households in India, about 580 to 600 million middle-class consumers, ladies and gentlemen. Again, some numbers which I won't bore you with. You will have copies of the presentation in the book given to you. The red one, again, is important. According to PricewaterhouseCoopers, India will overtake Chinese pace of growth by 2013. Think of that. India is known or got to be known in the international arena primarily because of our IT. It's not a huge amount. It's $60 billion worth of exports. Actually, it is less than the amount of gems and jewelry that we export. But this is significant because it's sexy. IT, you know. How are we managing to do that? India qualifies 3.5 million undergraduates every year. Another million postgraduates every year, and these numbers are growing 10 to 15%. Some other numbers, one in red, very significant. In the month of June 2007, India added 7.35 million new subscribers for cell phones. Highest ever anywhere in the world, even exceeding that of China. And this number is growing. I believe July, you'll see about 8 million being added. You can see the growth in internet connections and computers. But the interesting thing, all this growth is predominantly driven by Indian companies and not foreign companies using India as a base for low-cost, high-volume exports. What is the lesson that one can draw from this? I think it's obvious that growth and progress are indeed possible in a free democratic society working within an equitable and transparent legal system. Many, many Asian countries have said, well, you know, this Westminster model doesn't work, this parliamentary system. It won't work in Asia because the Asians are different. Yes, maybe Oriental Asians are different. India is not Oriental Asia, but we are proving to the world you do not have to be a totalitarian society, you do not have to be one party rule, you do not have to have a military dictator. You can go every 4 years, vote and kick out the previous guys. We're still showing growth and reasonable growth. So, don't want to be seen as China basher or whatever, but there's a little difference, and there's a contrasting model. So you see on one side, if you screen the two fathers of our nation, Jawaharlal Nehru and Mahatma Gandhi, sitting on the floor in homespun khadi, which is cotton done by a spinning loom. And the reason they did that, of course, was because all our cotton was to be taken to Manchester and made into textiles and sent back to India for the Indians to buy. And on the right, of course, Mr. To Be Rich is Glorious. A little different model. So this quotation from our current Prime Minister, I believe, is extremely valid. And he said, India's success will renew humanity's faith in liberal democracy, in the rule of law, and free and open societies. Once again, as I said, you do not have to be a one-party or totalitarian system. You can have a developing country show growth in a free society. But is this for real, or am I just a snake charmer, you know, showing this, making this little tune for you guys? But let's look at some other figures. The great demographic dividend. We've already seen the large numbers of Indians that will become middle class and consumers in the middle class. But look at these figures. 65% of India today is below 35 years of age. 50% of India is currently below 25 years of age. I mean, we all know the problems of aging in Europe, but even take China, for example. In the year 2025, 15% of Chinese will be over the age of 65. So as societies everywhere else begin to age, India will be providing the workers to the global society. Not the workers, just also the consumers to the global society. We're creating 20 million jobs every year. These are youngsters who are coming with lots of money, good salaries. These are becoming the consumers, but they're also saving. We already see that from a savings rate of about 23% in the year 2000, it's over 32% today. Come to India, you've seen some shots earlier. That is what is beginning to happen. But even more significant, we've seen the number of graduates and engineers and doctors and whatever that we produce. India is beginning to emerge as the knowledge hub and the knowledge base of the world. India is not, as I said, into low-cost manufacturing for export. Other countries practice that model. We don't. We believe that, like, the Industrial Revolution made Europe rich. The countries in the Middle East got rich on oil. India will become rich by using its brain power. So it is emerging currently as an R&D and design hub. But see, these are some names I have tossed in. The one company in black, Seabird Aviation, which is an Australian company, gets all its research and development done in India. The iPod chip was designed by a company in our city of Hyderabad. The iPhone, which has just been launched in the United States, 90% of all components which have gone into the iPhone have been designed in India. 25% of the world's expenditure on R&D is done in India, ladies and gentlemen. Other countries establish special economic zones for low-cost manufacture. We have something similar, but except only brains are used there, and they are called nerd towns, you know. So, I like that phrase, I coined it myself. I think India is going to be the world's rent-a-brain supermart. You want something done with your brain, man? Come, we'll do it for you. There's this huge emerging area of knowledge process outsourcing, R&D and design we have seen, but there are many other areas that are beginning to emerge. Legal services, ship and aircraft designing, development of new pharmaceuticals, it's all being done in India. The aircraft designing is interesting. Those of you who know Airbus, the A350, the designs have been done in India. The Boeing 787 Dreamliner was largely designed in India. So actually, you can think of a subject. It's already being done in India. I mean, most animation films or subtitling of movies for DVD are done in India. But also, as we go along, Indians are going global. I just tossed some names. I hope you recognize the very first one. Hotmail was not started by Microsoft. It was started by a young Indian boy called Sabir Bhatia, son of an ex-army officer of the Indian Army. And he got bored sitting in Silicon Valley doing nothing useful, so he decided to start Hotmail. And then he sold it to Microsoft. And there are some other names. The third name, Ellen Mittal, the world's largest steel producer. That's why I didn't put anything against his name. But when he was trying to take over Arcelor, the French chairman of Arcelor said, who are these Indians with monopoly money? Who do they think they are trying to do? Within 3 months, Arcelor was bought by Ellen Mittal. We have other names, the head of PepsiCo Global, sitting in the United States, a young Indian lady from southern state of Tamil Nadu, Indira Nui. She's head of PepsiCo. Another name that may be familiar to you, Vodafone. The boss of Vodafone is another Indian. And just some more names. If you have good stereo systems, most likely you have speakers made by Dr. Amal Bose, they're called Bose speakers. Some more names. The one in the different color, Raj Patel, ladies and gentlemen, the newest character in Archie Comics is this guy called Raj Patel, classmate of Archie. Eats vegetable burgers, he does not eat hamburgers. So, you know, Indians are going global. We also, of course, gave two very famous female astronauts to the United States space program. One of them unfortunately perished on re-entry, but Sunita Williams happily landed safely just a few weeks ago. But while Indians go global, India is also going global. Emerging phenomena. Here are just some names of companies that are now owned by Indians or by Indian companies. Significant names. The ones in red, of course, are Australian companies, regrettably, bought out by Indians. But you have other names there. You have Tetley Tea, if you have a good cup of tea in the morning. And if it's Tetley, it's owned by the Tatas. And if you imbibe White and Mackay Scotch, that's owned by Mr. Vijay Mallya of Kingfisher Beer fame in India, or Kingfisher Airlines. So next time you have White and Mackay Scotch, it's no longer from Scotland, it's made there, but it's made by an Indian. But more significant is the fact that inbound FDI is lower than India's outbound FDI. We spend more money in acquiring or investing overseas. The third highest investor in the United Kingdom, and shortly will be the second highest investor in the United Kingdom. And of course, we have outbound FDI in pretty much every country, including China. And that has led our Minister of Commerce and Industry to perhaps rightfully say, we no longer discuss the future of India. India is the future. Just a few points about trying to understand India. I mean, it's 1.2 billion people, 18 major languages. Our currency notes have 6 languages. You can speak in any of 11 languages in Parliament and ask for automatic translation. 1,600 minor languages and dialects. It's the world's largest democracy, blah, 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 blah. It's a land of great contrasts, lots of bigs and lots of nothing else. The former Undersecretary of the United Nations, Shashi Tharoor, said, anything you can say about India, the opposite also true. Great contradictions. Those of you who have visited our lovely country, you, I would imagine, recognize some of these contradictions. I'll take the last, and this is, of course, something to do with India's space program. As you know, we are a nuclear power, and we also have a major space program. It's a little different from other countries. We like to do useful things with our space program. This is an actual shot from our space research organization. That's the payload of one of our rockets being carried on a very modern vehicle. It's called a bicycle. But yet it gets in to this one, and that's going to the moon in 2010. So, ladies and gentlemen, this is India. I hope this sums it all up. Here's this holy guy who's now, instead of using a rolled up tobacco leaf, he now smokes a cigarette. And instead of a conch shell, he has a Nokia 1100. This, ladies and gentlemen, is India. And thank you very much for your patience.